National Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for August 2014. This is issue number 356. I'm your host, Fred Vobey. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. My email address for general inquiries is fvobey@realoldiesradio.com. All subscription and business goes to sales@nrcdxas.org. My telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. That's area code 419-8-6223, or capital Vobey. The number is not to be used for musings or reports to the DX Audio Service. The musings number and reports is 419-741-0205. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $30. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned. Or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. Well, before we get into the AM switch with Dave Alpert, I'd like to let you know that Wayne is cleaning house. He's got back issues of DX News available. The following issues of DX News are from Volume 55, Issue 28, through Volume 75, Issue 26, and they're available from the National Radio Club headquarters. You can receive individual issues to complete a year or complete years of copies. Please contact headquarters using the National Radio Club P.O. Box, which is Box 473-251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251. Or you can email sales@nrcdxas.org with your request. You will be notified of the cost of shipping, and your order will be packed and shipped after the payment has been received. Wayne says he will accept check and money orders at the P.O. Box, or let him know if you can establish the appropriate amount if you want to use PayPal. These items will be offered only until November the 11th, which gives everyone 90 days to order. After that date, the remaining overruns will be sent to the recycling center. Speaking of the recycling center, let's check out the AM switch and see which call signs have changed. Here's Dave Alpert.
Hi, everyone. Dave Alpert with the August AM switch. This issue, we have one edition, AM switch, volume 81, issue 28. Starting out with call changes. 820 WGGM, Chester, Virginia, changes to WNTW. 930 WAUR, Sandwich, Illinois, is now WKBM. 1160 WABY, Mechanicville, New York, changes to WAIX. 1310 KBOK, Malvern, Alabama, is now KZYP. 1340 KNTF, Oroville, California, is now KPYV. Up in the X-band, 1640 WKSH, Sussex, Wisconsin, becomes WSJP. And in addition to those changes, the prospective new owners of WBCK 930, Battle Creek, Michigan, have reserved WTOU for their calls when the sale is completed. New Station Watch, CPs for new stations, now on the air. The new station in Terre Haute, Indiana, on 1230 WIBQ, U1, 1 kilowatt day and night, is now officially on. And 1550 KDCO Golden, Colorado, a new station, U2, 990 watts day, 350 watts night, is officially on the air. CP's built and moving toward licensing. 890 KDPP in Olivehurst, California, applies for license to cover their construction permit for new station. When licensed, it will be U4, 10,000 watts day and 480 watts night. And we have an amendment to report for a new station construction permit granted, 1180 KCKQ in Reno, Nevada. Their existing CP was for U2, 7,500 watts day and 950 watts night. They were granted a change to U2, 4,000 watts day and 190 watts night, with city of license changed to Sparks, Nevada. By the way, the CP expires on November 9th, so we'll see if this one is built on time. New station CPs expiring in July, 640 WWAM, Piatone, Illinois. The CP for this station, U4, 4,800 watts day and 1,150 watts night, expired July 29th. We'll see if this moved station from Terre Haute actually got on. 1120 WBUR, Coral Springs, Florida, for a new station. U7, 9,500 watts day, 1,100 watts night. Critical hours power, 6,700 watts. Expired July 6th. 1230 KRAM, Beaverton, Utah. The CP for this new station, 1100 U1, 1,000 watts day and night. Expired on July 21st. And the CP for 1330 in Prescott Valley, Arizona, for a new station, U4, 800 watts day, 250 watts night, expired July 27th. Just so you know how this works, the CP expires and is deleted if the licensee fails to apply for a license to cover the CP by the expiration date, which is normally 3 years from the date of granting the construction permit, with extensions possible only in limited circumstances. It normally takes 2 or 3 weeks for the FCC to review an application for a license to cover and formally accept it for filing, and only then is there a public notice of the application. So usually we don't learn the official word on whether a CP is moving forward or not until a couple of weeks after the nominal deadline. Construction permits for existing stations on the air include 810 WJJQ, Tomahawk, Wisconsin, 820 WNYC, New York, New York, 970 WWRK, Florence, South Carolina, on with 10,000 watts day, 31 watts night, 1230 WENY, Elmira, New York, and 1470 WBCR, Alcoa, Tennessee. CPs for existing stations built, nearing service, include 870 KPRM, Park Rapids, Minnesota. They've applied for a license to cover CP for U2, 50,000 watts day and 1,000 watts night. The three-tower pattern shoots to the north-northwest. 920 KIHM, Reno, Nevada, granted program test authority for their CP for U2, 4,800 watts day, 850 at night. 1030 WCTS, Maplewood, Minnesota, applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 50 kilowatts a day, 4,000 watts at night. The two-tower day pattern is mostly north-northwest, while the night pattern is very tight, five-tower pattern to the north-northwest. 1330 WEBY, Milton, Florida, applies for license to cover their CP to modified day pattern. 1480 WEEO, Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, applies for license to cover their CP for U1, 410 watts day and 9 watts night. And 1580 KNIM, Merrillville, Missouri, applies for license to cover CP for U1, 480 watts day and 10 watts night. Construction permits granted to existing stations. 990 WGSO, New Orleans, Louisiana, granted a CP for U1, 600 watts day, 310 watts night from a new site. 1060 KFOY, Sparks, Nevada, granted CP for U2, 5,000 watts day, 500 watts night from a new site. 1110 WTIS, Tampa, Florida, granted a CP for U4, 10,000 watts day, 150 watts night, moving down from 1100 kilohertz. 1230 KZYM, Joplin, Missouri, is granted a CP for U1, 560 watts day, 600 watts night from a new transmitter site. And 1490 WMPX, Midland, Michigan, granted a CP for U1, 980 watts day and night. Application to modify existing construction permit, 1520 WXYB, Indian Rocks Beach, Florida. Licensed for D1 600 watts with a CP for U1 640 watts day and 17 watts at night. Applies to amend that construction permit to U1, 1,000 watts a day, 13 at night. Applications for CPs from existing stations, 630 KTKK, Sandy, Utah, applies for U4, 935 watts day and 484 watts night, changing the city of license to Kearns, Utah. They have a new site, which is essentially the same application filed last year. 830 WACC, Hialeah, Florida, modifies their pending application to U4, 4,100 watts day, 1,000 watts night. 1200 WXIT, Blowing Rock, North Carolina, applies for D1, 4,200 watts, diplexing with WATA 1450, which is a move of their site. 1360 WKAT, North Miami, Florida, applies for U1, 9,000 watts day and 400 watts night, diplexing with WOCN 1450. The lease for their old current site will not be renewed. 1520 KQQB Stockdale, Texas, applies for D3, 25,000 watts with critical hours power of 23,000. 1560 WMBH Joplin, Missouri, applies for U1, 500 watts day, 35 watts at night due to a move to a new transmitter site. By the way, the CP for 1520 WDCY Douglasville, Georgia, for D3, 50,000 watts day, has expired and has been deleted by the FCC. Here's a list of stations informing the commission they are silent. 780 WIIN, Ridgeland, Mississippi, silent since June 1st after the loss of their transmitter site. 960 WHYL, Carlisle, Pennsylvania, has been silent since April 18th, pending a sale by the bankruptcy trustee. 1060 WLNO, New Orleans, Louisiana, has been silent since June 2nd, pending a sale by bankruptcy trustee. 1170 WDIS, Norfolk, Massachusetts, has been off since June 3rd, but there's no explanation given to the FCC. If we have a member up that way who can find out the reason, we'd sure appreciate having the information. 1300 KSET, Lumberton, Texas, has been silent since May 9th after losing their programming source. 1340 WCMI, Ashland, Kentucky, silent since June 10th when their tower was destroyed by a tornado. 1340 KTSN, Elko, Nevada, silent since April 6th as it's not financially viable to operate on STA power. 1410 WELM, Elmira, New York, went silent May 30th due to defective capacitors in the transmitter. 1520 KTRI, Brunswick, Maryland, has been silent since April 14th when the station went into bankruptcy. 1560 KIQS, Willows, California, went silent June 26th when their transmitter fried from a lightning strike. And 1680 KRJO, Monroe, Louisiana, went silent June 10th due to financial problems. These are formerly silent stations informing the FCC they're no longer silent. 690 KEWI, Benton, Arkansas, was silent since February 7th, but they're back on the air as of June 20th. 790 WJNA, Ashland City, Tennessee, silent since June 6th, 2013, back on the air as of May 31st. 1150 KDEF, Albuquerque, New Mexico, silent since June 2nd, 2013, back on as of May 30th with an STA. 1230 WODI, Brookneal, Virginia, went silent on August 30th last year, but is now back on the air as of May 1st. 1240 KRAL, Rollins, Wyoming, went silent June 8th, 2013. KRAL is back on as of June 3rd. 1320 KSDT, Hemet, California, went silent June 4th, 2013. They're back on as of June 3rd with an STA. 1330 WGTF, Campbell, Ohio, went silent on January 21st. They're back on as of May 12th. 1400 WJWF, Columbus, Mississippi, silent since May 16th, back on May 31st with an STA. 1530 WOBX, Wanchese, North Carolina, went silent June 4th, but they're back on as of June 24th with an STA. and 1640 WSJP Sussex, Wisconsin, went silent September 28, 2013, as WKSH. They're back on as of June 4th with a new call, WSJP. Auction 84 action. Last issue, we reported on winners of auctions for new stations based on applications for new AM stations submitted in a 2004 filing window conducted by the FCC. Those who didn't win are seeing their applications dismissed. They include 620 in Boulder City and Henderson, Nevada, 720 in Windsor, Connecticut, 750 in San Angelo, Texas, 760 in Canyon, Adulu, and Sholo Water, Texas, 1220 in Kuna, Idaho, 1230 in Middleton, Ohio, 1340 in Alturas, California, 1340 in Lakeview, Oregon, 1370 in Cimarron Hills, and two applicants in Colorado Springs, Colorado, also 1370 in Bunkerville, New York, two applications for 1370 in Henderson, Nevada, and one for Las Vegas, Nevada, 1400 in Kachina Village and Prescott Valley, Arizona, 1400 in Waynesboro, Georgia, 1410 in Adrian, Michigan, Barnwell, South Carolina, Lebanon, Tennessee, 1490 in Bozeman, Montana, and in Lovelock, Nevada, also 1490 in Bend and Deschutes River Woods, Oregon, 1510 in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1540 in Spring Valley, Nevada, 1550 in Whitney, Nevada, 1600 in Huntsville, Alabama, 1600 in Warner Robins, Georgia, and 1600 in Charlottesville, Virginia. So if you have those applications penciled in as possible new stations, take them out, as each of the ones I just read off have been dismissed by the FCC and will never be built. By the way, applications for major changes in existing stations in auctions where there were no bidders include 1360 Galax, Virginia, WWWJ's application to move to 720 with a license change to Portsmouth, Virginia, and 1590 WABV, Abbeville, South Carolina, wanted to move to 1370 and change their city of license to Whitney, Nevada. That would have been a heck of a move. Applications that didn't compete or otherwise lost in auctions won by other applicants include 850 Enolo, Pennsylvania, 1190 Micanopy, Florida, 1130 Eaton, Colorado, 1210 Anchorage, Alaska, 1450 Montoursville, Pennsylvania, 1470 Huron, California, and 1700 Muncie, Stony Point Town, and Habistraw, New York. All saw their applications dismissed by the FCC in the auction process. Checking the FCC's cash register, 540 WWCS, Cannonsburg, Pennsylvania, has been fined $12,000 for failing to enclose their antenna with a locked fence. Fred Vobey says this is occurring more and more, and there are plenty more stations out there for the FCC to catch. 1140 WMMG Brandenburg, Kentucky has been fined $10,000 for public inspection file violations. 1230 WELM Elmira, New York fined $7,000 for failing to enclose their antenna with a locked fence. And 1380 KOTA Rapid City, South Dakota fined $10,000 for failing to maintain required night tower lights. Oh, Canada! Here are some Canadian updates from Sean Axelrod and Dan Siss. 540 CFCB Corner Brook, Newfoundland applies for U4 10,000 watts day, 1,000 watts night. They would be a great catch if you could hear them, probably as they switch from night to day power in the morning. 1110 CBLI Deep River, Ontario. This LPRT station applies to move to 97.9 FM. 1370 CKDR1 Ignacy, Ontario has their CP granted to move to 97.5. And 1610, the CP for the new station in Montreal, Quebec, has been assigned the call letters CHRN. It'll be known as Radio Humsafar, signaling an ethnic format. And that'll do it for the August 2014 edition of AM Switch. Remember, if you have any observations or changes in status, please pick up the phone and call into the Musings line at 419-741-0205 and let us know. Since we're a club and you're a member, we depend on you to be our field observer. I'm Dave Alpert, and as The Happening sung in 1965, we'll see you in September with another AM Switch. Till then, please get active with your radio club and support radio. Now, here's the DX Son of the North Star State with the August Band Scan.
National Radio Club.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everybody. Today, we are going to issue a great big challenge, and you're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to play for you a group of stations which were recorded on a trip we made from Minneapolis to Florida back during Minnesota Twins spring training in January, I think it was, of 2014. And what you're going to get is a whole long string of short IDs. And what we're going to ask you to do is figure out where we were when we made the recording. The clues, of course, will be the signals you hear, the relative signal strength, and your best guess. So I'm going to play these in a row. We apologize for the quality of some of them. You may not be able to copy the IDs. So at the end of this, we'll give you the list of call letters. And then what we want you to do is to call the Musings line and see how close you can pinpoint our listening location. Not sure what we'll give the winner that pinpoints the closest listening area location, but Fred and I will come up with something. So you get ready to call the Musings line after you listen to this a couple of times and tell us where you think we were. And the winner will be the one who gets the closest, obviously, not just the state, but the general area we were in. The only clue I'll give you right now is we were not in a major city. And that'll be obvious because there won't be any real clear signals coming in. So, having said all of that, we'll start to play these things. You start to log them, if you will, mentally or physically, and go back and play them a couple of times and try to guess where we were when we made these recordings. And then call the Musings line, and we'll see who wins. After that rather strenuous exercise, we're going to read you a story about WJR Detroit, the Goodwill station, and how it came to be in spite of the fact that the people who owned the station had no belief in radio. So let's get to work. Here is the string of IDs. We'll break these into two because they'll come at you rather rapid fire. Starting at 5:50.
You wanted it, now you've got it.
All sports, all the time.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
This is Panama City's ESPN Radio 590.
We're in the big rock and roll radio show, AM 610 WRUF, Russellville, Kentucky. We got a tune in on the Dodgers right front. High school basketball action coming up for you tonight at 5:45.
Thanks for listening to News Radio 630 WLAB, Lexington, and WLAB.com, and iHeart Radio System. It's 6 o'clock.
With all news all day, news before. News Radio 680 WACF, Raleigh, North Carolina.
WJOX Birmingham, a community station. This is AM 7, not 3.
Catholic Radio for the Crescent City, the North Shore, and the Gulf Coast is listed before WQNO New Orleans, K285 SF Battery. Donate online at CatholicCommunityRadio.org.
WAQI Miami. Aquí, Radio Mambi. La Grande.
Hello, over the weekend. The full forecast from Fox 23 Chief Meteorologist Dave Pitlock coming up on the KRMG News.
930 WTTK Louisville, a division of Salem Communications on the NASDAQ at SALM. Online at 970WTTK.com.
By Radio Teaching and Christian Music from WMAFN.
With us are a Navy Times 6 figures in Washington.
Tennessee, Mississippi, and Arkansas. The latest news stories are here. This is the Voice of Memphis, 990 KWAM, Memphis.
A news from Hampton, Toronto.
Good evening, it's 7 o'clock. I'm Dave Warner with your news talk, 10 updated. Minus 2 degrees at Young and St. Clair.
Okay, that's the first of the group. And remember, if you can figure out where we were listening based on what you heard, call the Musings line and make your best guess. Let's get on with it now. We've all had a chance to take a deep breath. Let's listen to the second group.
Every Sunday night from 8 to 9 p.m. on News Radio 1040 WHO Des Moines.
All news, all the time.
KYW,
KYWHC,
and 94.1
from 82
Philadelphia.
From Independence Mall, this is KYW News Radio 1060.
WAPI Birmingham, 1070 a.m. and live worldwide on iHeartRadio, a Cumulus station.
32 degrees at Richmond's traffic and weather station. News Radio 1140 WRVA covers Central Virginia in 3 minutes after Fox News Radio covers the world.
KFAQ Tulsa and KFAQ HD Tulsa. It's the top of the hour. Time for the top stories of the day. Your news update starts now.
1530. Jumping at the big yum.
And there we are. That's the group of stations recorded from a listening post back in January of 2014. And your job now is to call the Musings line and try to guess where we were. But let's see what kind of luck you have and skill. Here are the stations in order, as we heard them, in case you missed some. 550 WGR, 560 WNSR, 590 WDIZ, 610 WRUS, 630 WLAP, 680 WPTF, 690 WJOX, 690 WQNO, 710 WAQI, 740 KRNG, 970 WGTK, 980 WYFN, 990 KWAM, 1010 Toronto, 1020 KDKA, 1030 WBZ, 1040 WHO, 1060 KYW, 1070 WAPI, 1140 WRVA, 1170 KFAQ, 1190 WOWO, 1210 WPHT, 1220 WHKW, 1300 WNQM, and 1530 WCKY. I know some of these were tough. Here's that number again, 419-741-0205. And now, a story about WJR Detroit, a station that began and flourished in spite of itself.
This is the great voice of the Great Lakes, 760 WJR Detroit.
It's from the broadcaster's desktop resource entitled High Powered History by Barry Mishkin. Some stations have a long history. Once you hear their call letters, you immediately think of the market and some of the famous folks who worked there over the years. WJR in Detroit is one of those stations, growing from a shaky beginning in 1922 to become a 50,000-watt flamethrower and a well-known familiar brand where the Motor City turns to get news and information. Broadcasting in the early 1920s was not a secure profession. As with any new product or industry, the pioneering stations had a high rate of attrition. Some of them found the costs of operation too high or suffered from mismanagement. Others were unable to get enough airtime during the years when all the stations were packed into just a few channels and they had to share time. And some owners just lost interest. The birth of WJR Radio was afflicted with several of these problems. Although a 50-kilowatt powerhouse today in Detroit with a long history of service to the community, the station barely survived its first years. Even getting started was not easy. Building a legendary brand in the broadcast industry was not what Edie Stair, owner of the Detroit Free Press, had in mind. Stair reluctantly permitted his general manager, W.H. Pettibone, to start a radio station to meet the competition from WWJ, the Detroit news station. In his mind, WWJ radio was little more than a frill. Stair was skeptical it would ever amount to very much, so he did not expect much from Pettibone's idea either. The Free Press station, WCX, Pontiac, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, debuted on May 4, 1922, with impressive sign-on ceremonies that were typical for the pioneer stations of the time. Reception reports came in by telegram and letter from many cities, some as far away as Texas and Arkansas. However, Stair still was not impressed. Many engineers today will instantly guess one big reason why that happened. Despite all the places where the station could be heard loudly and clearly, including on the telephones of local residents, one of the few dead spots just happened to be the area near the Belle Isle Bridge, the location of Stair's home. Getting talent was another big difficulty. The local theater owners quickly decided radio was a competitive threat and kept many professional artists from appearing on WCX. Long periods of silence did not help the station attract listeners either. The staff did persevere, searching for ways to find and develop a listening audience. Station manager Neil Tomey did his best, guiding the station move to 580 kilohertz in 1923, and then devising a contest to see how much of an audience was really out there. A Michigan Red Apple was offered to the first listener who identified a particular singer. So many responses arrived that WCX decided to organize the Red Apple Club, which grew to a 500,000 members in less than a year. Nevertheless, Starr still was not impressed, even by the bags and bags of fan mail. He chafed at the $15,000 it took to operate the station for the year. WCX had seemed unable to attract much advertising, and most of its programs had run unsponsored. Thus, Stair was very interested when his friend Edward Jewett offered a proposition. Jewett's new station, WJR, which stood for Jewett Radio, would provide a new transmitter and $75,000 a year in financing if the two stations would share facilities. The combined WJR-WCX premiered on August 16, 1925, the second station after WLW to go superpower at 5,000 watts. Unfortunately, Jewett was not a very good owner-manager, and financial crises arose almost immediately. With Stair unwilling to put in any additional money, the stations came to the brink of financial collapse in March of 1926. The future looked very bleak at WJR-WCX. Jewett Radio was to be liquidated. And yet, out of this disaster, the station rose to success under the leadership of the man hired to dismantle the broadcast station, Leo Fitzpatrick. Fitzpatrick had come to WJR from the successful WDAF program, Kansas City Nighthawks. The merry old chief was determined to make WJR-WCX successful. He convinced the liquidator to allow him time to try. Among his first actions, Fitzpatrick had the station's antenna reoriented more toward Detroit. With an improved signal, attention then was given to finances. Advertising was still a rather hard sell to many businesses, which were slow to appreciate the intangible nature of radio advertising. Fitzpatrick came up with the idea of selling sponsorship announcements tied to the station IDs. It turned out to be very successful. Among those in whom Fitzpatrick found an appreciation of the power of radio and ready to pay full commercial rates were several local churches. One of these sponsors was destined to become one of the most famous, controversial, and most reviled of all broadcasters, Father Charles Coughlin. The turnabout came very quickly. After just 1 month, WJR was operating with a monthly profit. And that success attracted the attention of one of the station's major sponsors, G.A. Richards. Noting the prestige and goodwill his Oakland and Pontiac automobile dealerships got from his association with WJR, Richards decided to option and then purchase the station. With Richards' money and flair for showmanship, WJR, which he dubbed the Goodwill Station, was quickly established as a major factor in the market. New studios were built, NBC's Blue Network was picked up, and special broadcasts were put on to show the immediacy and importance of radio. Even the Federal Radio Commission helped by permitting WJR-WCX to move to 680 kHz, then later to 750, during part of the national frequency change on November 11, 1928. Best of all, WJR-WCX was now all alone on that channel. The strategy worked. Even the theater owners took note and began permitting remote broadcasts right from their stages. WJR prospered so much that Richards retired from the automobile business to devote himself to radio. He shared the station's prosperity, annually granting generous bonuses to the staff. Then new studios and offices were built in the brand new Fisher Building, and from the golden tower of the Fisher Building became a common on-air slogan. Soon, Richards offered to buy out WCX. This delighted E.D. Stair, who had never liked radio in the first place. And with that, WCX just faded away in early 1929. By contrast, WJR continued to grow. The Depression made entertainment broadcasts on radio even more important to many people. Listeners came to expect news as another essential service, so WJR began to develop a greater news image, including interviewing newsmakers on the air. Live musical programs were also a station staple well into the 1970s. In the 1930s, the tightening financial situation worsened as the Depression deepened. According to the New York Telegram, every 50,000-watt station in the country ended 1929 in deficit. In contrast, G.A. Richards decided to increase WJR's power to 10,000 watts, mainly to protect their clear channel status. Although the transmitter site was moved 31 miles out into the countryside, 2 years later the station officially changed its city of license to Detroit. Then a 1935 fight with NBC over compensation led to a change in affiliation. Simultaneously with the inauguration of a new 50,000-watt transmitter, WJR changed to the CBS radio network. Of course, it was not all easy. In November of 1940, heavy winds knocked over the station's 733-foot tower. It was replaced with a slightly shorter 700-foot tower. One more change of address occurred as part of the national frequency move in March 1942. The station moved up 10 kHz, bringing WJR to its current location at 760. The desire to ensure the best possible programming occasionally led WJR to more disagreements with the national networks over the years, but as it was highly rated, the networks allowed WJR latitude that no other stations got at the time. As television grew in the 1950s, the radio industry underwent major changes, and WJR had to work hard to stay at the top of its game. As part of the merger of Cap Cities and ABC in 1985, the network affiliation was changed. Cap Cities ABC Disney operated the station for 42 years, selling it to Citadel Communications in January 2006. In September 2011, Citadel merged into Cumulus Media, the current ownership. WJR continues to serve the Detroit market with a news and talk format. Over five decades, WJR changed as the industry changed, slowly shifting from a full-service station to a news sports talk format. Most recently, the emphasis is on the talk format, both local and satellite delivered, along with a reworked sports presentation. In 2006, the station even built a studio in the Renaissance Tower in the middle of downtown Detroit. to provide easy access for interviewing local celebrities and sports figures. Now 92 years down the line from the tiny seeds at WCX, the great voice of the Great Lakes continues to sport the WJR call letters and presents its strong image in the local community.
This is the great voice of the Great Lakes, News Talk 760. An ABC radio station.
From ABC News.
And that story, entitled WJR, the Goodwill Station, was written by Barry Mishkin in his Broadcaster's Desktop Resource. The article was entitled High Powered History. And that, dear friends, is our August band scan. We hope that you were able to participate and made a good guess on the musings line. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We're here every month or so, and we, with all good luck, will be back next month to continue our Bandscan series. Until then, good listening, DXers. National Radio
Club. If you're a radio listener who's heard programs such as Michio Kaku or Coast to Coast AM, where they talk about solar flares and the impact on our radios and transmission facilities, then you might find some interest with this story. It's titled Preparations to Avert Major Disaster Due to Big Solar Storms Should Begin in Earnest. This story was in the magazine Dumbout, a magazine about knowledge, and written by Deborah Paulson. Scientists reveal that a solar flare was fired from the sun on July 23rd of 2012 and struck our planet. But fortunately, the CME, or Coronal Mass Ejection Plasma Cloud, did not strike Earth but ejected off to the side. It spat out an eruption at 1,800 miles per second, which is four times faster than a normal eruption. Daniel Baker, University of Colorado, said that if it had hit Earth, we would still be picking up the pieces. These findings were published in the journal Space Weather. The timing also played an important part in averting a major disaster. If it had struck 7 days earlier, it would have hit Earth, as Earth would have been in the direct line of fire. Our GPS systems would have collapsed and power supplies would have been permanently damaged. We are fortunate that our urban water networks and electrical pumps are still working today. NASA had positioned the Stereo A spacecraft to study the solar outbursts, which are known as CMEs. Scientists use the Carrington event as a benchmark. On September 1, 1859, a powerful solar storm was observed by astronomer Richard Carrington in England. A geomagnetic storm that lasted for nearly 5 minutes flung a massive amount of highly charged particles, CMEs, toward Earth. It resulted in the failure of numerous telegraph networks that were installed in Europe and North America. The July 12th storm would have delivered a similar geomagnetic storm if it had erupted from the side of the sun that faced the Earth, and if the orientation for interaction between Earth's magnetic field and the plasma magnetic field was right. According to solar scientists, there is a 12% probability that a solar storm can strike the Earth in the next 10 years. It is important to prepare for the next solar storm by trying to avoid horrific effects with proper risk management. So, how prepared are you?
Countries like the U.S., everything from our sewage systems to our Wall Street banks operate with our power grid. And a game-changing solar storm that could hit at any time. So, how worried should we be? Sounds like we should be. Michio Kaku is an astrophysicist and author of The Physics of the Impossible. Sir, good morning to you. Welcome back here.
Glad to be on your show.
Now, what I'm reading here scares me to death. Should I be that way?
That's right. We're talking about a potential Katrina from outer space. Katrina caused about $100 billion in property damage. And unless we begin to make efforts now to reinforce our satellites and power grid, we could have something maybe 10 times bigger than Katrina, because we're talking about the loss of all electricity and all satellite activity. We'd be thrown 100 years back into the past.
Michio, has this happened before?
In 1859, we had a humongous storm that wiped out telegraph poles, and we tried to then estimate what kind of power could do that. And we now realize that we are very young in the space age. If something like the 1859 storm hit again, it would literally paralyze all the United States, not just for a day or an hour, but for months to years. Our transformers would short circuit and burn out. Satellites would be fried to a crisp. And the sun, however, has these storms every 11 years. Every 11 years, the magnetic field flips.
Well, we have never before in our history, in human history for that matter, relied so much on technology as we do today. And that's part of what they found in the study, because we rely so much on our ability to communicate through our computers that they would all go down, which would handicap not just New York, but really the eastern half of the United States. That's what the study finds, which would be far worse than the blackout of New York from 4 years ago, Michio.
That's right. Those blackouts only last for a few hours to a day. But if you start to short circuit all the transformers and blow out the satellites and fry the communications grid, then you're talking about knocking out the United States for months before we can get enough rescue crews and repairmen to handle not just one city, but hundreds of cities around the United States.
You know, Michio, sometimes you come on here and you sound like the doctor of doom and gloom. Does this, does something like this keep you up at night?
It does, and I think with Katrina, you know, engineers knew that Katrina could happen, but they did nothing because they said that it's not going to happen while I'm around. Well, now we learned the lesson. You have to prepare for things, especially when you know that at some point it's inevitable that we're going to have another big one, like we had back in 1859, except this time we're totally dependent on electricity.
Michio, thank you. Hope to see you in person next time. We'll take you on the phone if we can. Michio Kaku, thank you for your time today.
This story appeared in the magazine Dumbout, a magazine about knowledge, and was written by Deborah Paulson. The name of the story? Preparations to avert major disaster due to big solar storms should begin in earnest. In Lima, Ohio, I'm Fred Vobey for the DX Audio Service.
Hall of Fame opens Crosley exhibit. This article appeared in Radio Inc. for July 15th. The National Radio Hall of Fame has opened a new exhibit celebrating the contributions of WLWAM Cincinnati founder Powell Crosley, Jr. The exhibit chronicles the life and career of an innovator who made radio history, bringing radio to the masses through the manufacturing of inexpensive radios. The 30-foot by 10-foot wall timeline features six of Crosley's radios, dating back to the 1930s, and explains the role Crosley played in our nation's history as an inventor, broadcaster, and businessman. The exhibit also features a brief video biography of Crosley's remarkable career. The exhibit was made possible thanks to a donation from the Bradenton Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, the tourism marketing arm of Manatee County, Florida. The CVB operates and maintains the Powell Crosley Estate on behalf of the ownership of Manatee County government. By the time of his death in 1961, Crosley had invented, introduced, manufactured, or produced the following, all of which are celebrated through the National Radio Hall of Fame exhibit. WLW Radio Cincinnati, the nation station, which fed network programming to NBC and Mutual in the 1930s and used an unprecedented experimental 750,000-watt transmitter. The first compact economy car. The first auto radio. Introduction of soap operas to radio. Introduction of night baseball as part owner of the Cincinnati Reds. The facsimile machine, the 35-millimeter camera, and four different types of airplanes. NBC President Bruce Dumont said, Powell Crosley, Jr. made monumental contributions to the United States and to the radio industry. His innovation and vision helped define radio as an important medium, bringing people together and sharing a culture. This new exhibit commemorates his hard work and dedication to radio. Many of the exhibit's features are on loan from the Manatee County Historical Records Library and the Powell Crosley Estate, both in Bradenton, Florida. Crosley's winter home with a multi-million dollar mansion, built in 1929, still remains on the shores of Sarasota Bay and is on the National Register of Historic Places. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Phil Wayne.
Radio's quiet game changer that could crush Pandora. This article by Rocco Pandola and appeared on the website thestreet.com. You're unlikely to hear much about this in the financial or tech media, but it's a big deal. Given the media's desire to create and perpetuate Pandora killers that always fail to materialize, you would think they would pay attention to something that actually matters. But as usual, they're not. The only place you'll hear about this is in the radio trades that nobody outside of radio reads, and now my column. Intercom Communications is a small company that owns broadcast radio stations. A few days ago, it introduced the 2-Minute Promise on what is already a pretty good alternative radio station in Seattle, 107.7 The End, KNDD. It's a simple but bold new initiative. Cut the number of commercials played per hour in half. Never play more than 2 minutes of commercials in a row. Refocus on music discovery. Cut down on music repetition. And maybe most importantly, do not fire disc jockeys to fund the endeavor. Shortly after the Seattle announcement, a privately owned Fresno radio station made a similar move. It will play no more than 5 minutes of commercials per hour, giving advertisers, as RadioInfo.com put it, ownership of each break. Expect more stations to follow suit. Once Clear Channel and Cumulus Media follow suit, the game doesn't simply change. It breaks completely wide open, in traditional radio's favor, on its own terms. A couple key points to consider. This will immediately raise the value of advertising on radio. Radio stations will be able to charge more, focusing on premium clients. Because instead of seeing the advertisement you pay for get buried in a sea of commercials, you receive featured treatment, ownership, prime placement. Whatever you want to call it, it redefines the notion of buying time on a radio station. It became routine, mundane, screw programmatic. Now, radio advertising gets some of its flair back. Some businesses eventually will not be able to afford to advertise on radio. In what will be a dramatic shift, radio stations will no longer have to scratch and claw to put any client willing to spend on the air. Instead, they'll pick and choose. If anybody loses, it's individual sales reps in radio sales departments, whose services might not be quite as needed as they once were. Or, radio will have to come up with ways to create venues for leftover clients. This will allow radio companies to focus on the on-air product, which will only increase the value of airtime and put heat on Pandora. Speaking of Pandora, over the past few months, we have heard a considerable bit about Pandora gradually increasing the number of commercials it plays per hour. It has no choice, really, given the economics of its business. But playing fewer commercials has always been a key selling point for Pandora over traditional radio. These moves in Seattle and Fresno dramatically close that gap. In fact, one day a gap might not even exist. In May, Pandora played roughly 2.5 minutes of commercials per hour, which is actually down a wee bit from the previous month, based on testing in 4 representative markets. But even if a gap does exist, it's all about the perceived and ultimately actual value of an advertisement from the advertiser's point of view, as well as the perceived and ultimately actual pleasure of the listening experience from the listener's point of view. From a listener standpoint, traditional radio wins if more stations embrace the idea of refocusing on personality, along with more and better music on stations that play music, alongside fewer, more lucrative premium, that's the key, commercial breaks. That's one thing Pandora has never had, and sans a complete overhaul of its business model, can never have. Personality, which is the one thing that best drives and nurtures the proceeding too. Make no mistake, real-life human beings connecting with an audience of real-life human beings is the key ingredient to success. Personality wins, and if traditional radio by and large goes along with KNDD's move to level the playing field, Pandora, assuming it continues to stand still, will lose. The two-minute promise will likely take on several forms, but if it materializes the way I expect it to, it will be the Pandora killer the media, oddly, in all of its hyperbole, happened to miss. In Lexington, Kentucky, this is Chris Gay for the DX Audio Service.
Thanks, Chris. On the AM radio list, somebody pointed out a YouTube copy of a song by Steely Dan that was recorded, that the lyric was changed. You remember the movie back in the late 70s called FM, and the song by the same name, FM by Steely Dan. Well, it seems that Dan Taylor of WNBC didn't particularly like No Static at All FM being played on a AM radio station. So it was changed. Unfortunately, the YouTube copy was very poor quality. But guess who's got it in his collection? I thought you might like to hear it. Here's the AM version of Steely Dan's FM as we conclude part one.